Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, entertainment, and, well, a little bit of everything. But before we go any further, I want to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Let me just say that today we're going to dedicate this show to a new patient of mine named Clayton, who came to my office over on Mission Street the other day and said, I want you to help me change the culture of modern oncology. It's like, wow, okay, tell me more. Basically, oncology as we currently practice it in conventional medicine is a fear-based specialty. Over and over again, if you ask oncologists as a patient, as a cancer patient, can I use this antioxidant or that herb? You generally get a very negative answer. It's like, no, it's dangerous. We don't know if it interacts with the chemotherapy. Be afraid. Be very afraid. There is no data. And that is just not true. They're telling the truth as they know it, which is there's no data that I know of. Let me tell you, folks, there is a lot of data. So what we're going to be doing today, besides giving you some helpful hints for how to approach management of cancer, we're going to be talking about the references and about the overwhelming weight of data that supports these comments. But for those of you who don't have cancer and just want to stay well, I have a quick bit of advice for you. This one just reported, the person doing the work is Dr. Bahram Armandi, who is at Florida State University, and he recently studied apples. What Dr. Armandi wanted to know was, does an apple a day really keep the doctor away? A very good study was constructed here by the good doctor. This is a study looking at 160 women who were from 45 to 65 years old, and they got placed in one of two groups: either dried apples daily, 75 grams for a year, or dried prunes daily. It was blood samples at 3, 6, and 12 months. Armandi is quoted as saying, there were incredible changes in the apple-eating women. By 6 months, they had experienced a 23% decrease in their LDL cholesterol. The daily apple consumption led to a lowering of lipid hydroperoxide levels and C-reactive protein. So in other words, less LDL and less oxidized LDL, which is the stuff that gets into the arteries and causes plaque. They also increased their HDL cholesterol by about 4%, and they lost an average of 3 pounds, this despite adding 240 calories to their diet. So in this case, they were eating a little bit more than one apple a day, but nevertheless, rather striking benefits and a good blinded study. The women did not know which capsules they were consuming. They weren't aware which fruit they were getting. Presumably, they would not have made other dietary changes. I found this fascinating, and I'm going to stock up on apples. Our special guest is here, and this is Sandy Reschemacher, and I hope I'm saying your name right, Sandy. And she is here to talk about Food for Life, which is a cooking program for cancer patients. Hello, Sandy. Welcome to the program.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for calling me up.
Well, tell us about this cancer project, the Cancer Project, and the Food for Life program.
Yeah, the Cancer Project is a nonprofit organization out of Washington, D.C. It's been around for 20 years or so, started by Dr. Neil Barnard. He's been doing his own research and has gathered other people's research. And the point is to bring all the information about food that helps prevent cancer and or help you survive cancer if you've had it, and put it into a program. And he has people like myself as instructors all over the United States disseminating this information. And it's incredible new science that so many people don't know about that's finally getting out to the masses.
Yeah, I'd like to get it out to the masses of physicians, too.
Well, this is the problem, is that they don't teach nutrition in med school, and this wonderful host of scientists that I've met up with over the past 30 years have now proven through the science, through clinical trials, that you can not only prevent but reverse so many chronic conditions through diet and nutrition. The problem is that the other components, the people who promote drugs and surgery, they have so much money, and so we don't hear the wonderful news that, yeah, diet is like 30% help with keeping us healthy and strong and fit. So this is a great opportunity to get in on some classes where you can learn the newest science. And also, in the class time, we provide so much, I call it mouth-on, not just hands-on, but mouth-on, tasting new foods and seeing how yummy and easy and simple this new, well, actually, it's not really new. It's been around a long time, but new ways for a lot of people of eating. They can taste new items that they might not have tasted before. And you do it with a bunch of other people that are all kind of on the same journey, or the same path along the journey.
Now, the Food for Life program is a class that's going to be starting up here in Santa Cruz County soon, right? You have a class starting next week, I believe?
This next series, it is a series of four Tuesday nights, starts on April 26th, coming up real soon. I've done the series in Santa Cruz for over the last year. People come from as far as San Jose and Santa Clara to learn about, you know, what's going to help them, like I said, prevent and survive cancer. I tell people it's not just that. It's an opportunity for anybody to learn how to eat well, because there's so much misinformation. A lot of times, you know, I talk to people as a nutritional consultant, and they say, oh, yeah, I eat really well. That's their opening line, and I realize you can't know how to eat well unless you know the science behind it. You know what to eat works best in your body at this particular, you know, time in your life, different ages, different sexes, different, all these different pieces of our life dial in, oh, I need this now and I need that.
Yeah.
So it's just important to get information, because once you have information, then you have choices.
Sandy, tell us how people can, I'm sold.
Yeah.
Tell us how people can find out about the class, enroll. Is there a website? Is there a phone number?
Oh, yes. You can go to www.cancerproject.org/classes to sign up. You can call me at 325-3811 to sign up. Again, that's 325-3811. I can help you sign up. The classes can also be information found on the New Leaf Community Market website. It's going to be at the Community Market on the west side of Santa Cruz. They have a wonderful new community classroom that's all set up with a kitchen. So, again, you can either sign up at the cancerproject.org site, or you can call me at 325-3811, or you can go to the New Leaf Community Market website to find more information.
Excellent. We'll go ahead and post a link to that website on the Ask Dr. Dawn resources page, so people can also just go there if they didn't get those addresses. And it was, again, cancerproject.org, without the without the article.
Yeah, no, the cancerproject.org/classes. I just want to put in a word in for the Cancer Project itself. Dr. Bernard has done a fabulous job over the last 20-some years. He is promoting these classes and underwriting a lot of it. So this class would probably come to the public as a fee of $250, is now only being charged a minimal of $90. So it's a great deal to get in on right now.
Yeah, $30 a class, four classes. No, less than that. Sorry,
oh, yeah.
I'm not doing my math right.
Yeah.
More like 20-something.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, very good, and thank you so much.
No problem. I'm there to just give people these options so they can dial in their health.
Well, I think I might send a spy and get all your tricks.
Oh, definitely.
All right. Have a great day.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Dawn.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. So about a year ago, I went to a wonderful conference that was titled Rethinking Cancer as a Chronic Disease. One of the phenomenological things that happens, and I've observed it in my practice again and again, and it's quite distressing, is that a primary care doctor usually will be the person who makes the diagnosis of cancer, because we're doing the screening studies. And we'll send the person perhaps to a surgeon for a biopsy, and the cancer will be diagnosed. And at that point, we bring in our oncological colleagues. And often at that point, from my perspective, the patient sort of drops off the face of the earth. They stop coming into my office for checkups. I don't see them for perhaps 6 months, 12 months. And meanwhile, I'm receiving periodically reports of their progress, but it's a very distant thing, and it it's made to feel like there's really no role for the primary care physician in the management of cancer. And that's really wrong. We have a broken system in that respect. One of the problems with cancer chemotherapy and all of the other things is that there's a great deal of options and choices, and people kind of enter into this, as I see it, sort of a machine, and there's a kind of an assembly line process to it. And yes, there are options, and those are discussed by the oncologists well with the patient. We could go this way and we could go this way. But I don't really feel like the patients are even slightly empowered by this process. It seems to me more that they are rendered extremely passive and fearful, and their symptoms with respect to, say, nausea, vomiting, weight loss are dealt with, but they're dealt with drugs. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, there's a very strong resistance to using other simple food-based things that might be helpful because of the misperception on the part of the oncologists that they might be interfering with chemo. And actually, we do know about what interferes with chemo, and we have lots of data on that as well. So I thought I would start out with just a couple quickies of things that we do know that do have interactions. Two compounds I use a lot in my practice, N-acetylcysteine and alpha-lipoic acid. These compounds can bind the platin drugs. So if they're circulating in your bloodstream, they may make those platinum drugs less effective. So those would be things to steer away from, and there is good data on that. Another one is glucosamine. A lot of people use that for arthritis. And if you are taking the two chemotherapy agents, etoposide or adriamycin, you can interfere with the inhibition of the cancer cells that these drugs are trying to achieve. Quercetin, which is a common drug used for common herb used for allergies, can interfere with cyclophosphamide and with the taxanes like Taxol. So there are known interactions, and they have been identified. I want to mention vitamin E and beta carotene in particular, because those have been kind of tarred with this, oh, absolutely do not take these if you're on any kind of cancer therapy. And the actual data that showed that showed that there was a problem with beta carotene in a very narrow group of people, people who were lung cancer patients who continued to smoke and who were getting active radiation therapy, saw less effect on their tumors. If the people had stopped smoking, they actually got better with beta carotene. If they were non-smokers with chemotherapy, they had a benefit from beta carotene. But when this study came out, similar to the Women's Health Initiative study, it got spun in the press and got into everybody's head. Oh, beta carotene interferes with radiation therapy. Oh, would that it were that simple. The complex systems discussion we had in the last hour, which I listened to while I was driving in, is a far better and more accurate way to think about the dynamics of nutrition and cancer. And many people are told, well, don't take beta carotene. And that becomes kind of, well, I can't take that even after my radiation therapy. Or I can't take this, or that might be bad for me. And so people get onto these diets that are essentially nutrient poor, carbohydrate rich, particularly simple starch rich. And we'll come back to that in nutrition in a little bit. But I want to do a digression here before I tell you what has been shown to be helpful and say that the basic physiology of cancer cells is like anaerobic bacteria. They are living, most cancer cells are living in the middle of a tumor, and there isn't that great a blood supply into the middle of a tumor. So those cancer cells are getting by on what will diffuse into the center, and it's a low oxygen environment. Well, anybody who's taken basic biology, at least at the high school level, remembers something called Krebs cycle and oxidative phosphorylation, which is what happens in the mitochondria. In other words, you need oxygen to make energy. So cancer cells work by glycolysis, which uses just sugar. Glycolysis can't use fat. It can't use protein. It has to use sugar. And so if you are eating a high sugar diet, you're feeding your cancer cells. Let me say that again. It's so important. If you're eating a high sugar, high simple starch diet, the kind that gives you diabetes, you're also feeding your cancer cells. So you want to make most of your calorie consumption from foods that cancer cells can't metabolize. That would be things like healthy fats, lots of nuts, protein. These are things cancer cells have trouble using. But the rest of your cells, they don't have any trouble at all using these. And so why aren't we putting people on these diets? Well, alternative cancer centers are, and they're seeing good results, particularly long-term in people who have positive nodes or who have positive metastases, which are then treated. But let me frame it this way for you. If we start thinking about cancer as a chronic disease, then that means there's probably still cancer cells out there washed up on the shores in your liver and your bone marrow, and you don't want to do anything that helps those cells survive. You want them to remain dormant. You want to make your immune system strong. You want to enhance your natural killer activity, which is the first line of defense against a tumor when it starts to grow. You want to make sure that those cells physiologically are disadvantaged so they stay dormant. You can live with the cancer much in the way that with the protease inhibitors, we've been able to get AIDS patients to live with their HIV. In other words, yes, I have HIV, but I'm disadvantaging the virus, so it's not taking over my physiology and destroying my immune system. Well, yes, I have cancer, and I am not able to expunge every last cancer cell from my body, but I can adapt my physiology and adapt the inputs into this complex system such that I disadvantage those cells and advantage the parts of the system that keep those cells in check. And there is an enormous, and I do mean enormous, body of science behind this. And I just don't understand why it isn't embraced. And yes, you could come up with all the conspiracy theories of, well, you know, the medical industrial complex, and maybe that's a part of it. But I just think it's plain information overload. I think that the physicians are good-hearted people who would want to heal their patients, and they simply don't have the information, and they're too busy and too overloaded by all of the articles about new chemo agents and the greatest and latest and greatest cancer vaccine that they're trying to keep up. They're doing a due diligence effort to keep up, but they're missing the low-hanging, pardon the pun, but they're missing the low-hanging fruit that would really help people live longer. So we're going to take just a moment and take a deep breath, because I told you that cancer don'ts. Now I'm going to tell you some of the cancer do's. And these are general things that have made a huge difference. I want to talk about prostate cancer, because you can search Dean Ornish and prostate cancer and find a fabulous and groundbreaking article. This is a study that's been ongoing for several years now, I think about 5 years. And what Dr. Ornish has done is he's taken people with biopsy-proven cancer, prostate cancer, and he has put them on a low-fat, high vegetarian type diet, so whole grains, lots of vegetables, vegetable protein, not animal protein. And over the course of several years, those cancers have not progressed, and they've re-biopsied the people. And what they have shown in all of the adherence of the diet, and this has been almost uniformly successful across all subjects, is they've shown that changes in the DNA of the cancer cells in terms of what DNA is being expressed, what surface markers are there, how rapidly the cells are dividing, all the sorts of cytologic and biochemical markers for aggressiveness of cancer. And what they've shown is that these cancers are quieting down. They're backing down. They are changing into kinder, gentler cancers as a result of a dietary manipulation, which is quite inexpensive and does not involve any high-cost pharmaceuticals. So this is not theoretical. This is not in animals, this is in humans, and it's biopsy proven. And did you hear about this in the news? Did you? I sure didn't. I didn't see any major press conferences. I didn't see this on the 6 o'clock news. I want to know why I didn't. Well, I don't know. You can answer that question yourself the way you would like, but I think that there is a lot of extremely important low-lying fruit. A couple more things. In people who are getting surgery, when they're early on in their cancer process, where they're getting their cancer removed, you want to avoid things that are going to make you bleed. And that means a lot of the things I recommend, like omega-3 fatty acids and ginseng and vitamin E and garlic. You want to take those away for a while because you don't want to bleed. You want to stop St. John's wort, valerian, kava, and milk thistle because you don't want anesthesia complications, and those have been implicated. And this is just during the surgery. Just before the surgery starts and after, for 6 weeks, if you take fractionated citrus pectin, it's been shown to bind to the tumor cells and keep them from adhering to the endothelial cells. Now, what happens when we do a surgery is we take out the cancer. Well, guess what? Little cells shake off. There is a release, and this is documented, of circulating cancer cells. So right after we remove a cancer, for a short period of time, there are cancer cells in the bloodstream, more of them, because there's always a few. Well, if you take this citrus pectin, 8 grams twice a day, and it's not a big deal, you can mix it in applesauce or yogurt, it binds to the gallatin-3 receptors on the tumor cells, which are what they use to attach to the inside of the blood vessel wall. And if they can't attach, then they get killed by the natural killer cells that are circulating in the bloodstream. They don't have a chance to climb into your bone marrow. They don't have a chance to climb into your liver and hide. So why shouldn't this be standard therapy? Citrus pectin, I mean, for goodness sakes. The study is in JNCL, which is Journal of National Cancer Institute, 1995, volume 87, page 348. Why aren't we doing this? Another important thing, post-op, cimetidine. This is available over-the-counter as Tagamet, has been shown to suppress vascular adhesion and improve natural killer cell activity. Echinacea does that too. Good studies, good science, human studies even. So let's be scientific. Let's not be this silo of knowledge that doesn't look outside of its own journals for things that are intimately and directly important to be doing. There'll be more in the next weeks about cancer, and I'm going to be posting blogs about this on my Facebook page, which you can find by searching Ask Dr. Don Motika on Facebook. And let's go to Tom in Aptos. Hello, Tom, and welcome to the program. Thank you for holding.
Thank you for taking the call. Very timely with what I'm going through, because I had an esophageal cancerous tumor that was recently removed about 8 weeks ago, and they did the I forget the name of the procedure, but they basically do an esophagectomy and pull your stomach up to the more up towards your throat.
They give you the world's biggest hiatal hernia, basically.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm surviving it okay, and I survived the surgery. And I've been reading, you know, a lot of the books about the nutrition and cancer. But this is a little bit on the side tangent from that. But so my doctor's got me, or my GI doctor's got me on proton pump inhibitors for life, he says. And I will have some kind of reflux, more of an acid feeling if I don't take them, because you can imagine I don't have that barrier anymore for
right.
the reflux.
Yeah, you so no longer have a sphincter.
Right. So I sleep with, you know, I got to sleep with my head elevated, and that's all fine. But I'm wondering about some of the nutritional aspects of always being on PPIs, and is there some alternatives I can consider in regards to that?
Okay, well, let's start with some basic, really basic stuff, which is calcium and B12 are going to be issues for you.
Right.
Those both require acid for digestion. So with respect to the calcium, you can get around that by using a powdered form of calcium that will dissolve, and so the calcium that's going in is ionic. There are a couple of formulas out there. Pure Encapsulations makes a powder that's a calcium powder. There's a company called Ionic Fizz that makes both a magnesium and a calcium. I'm not receiving any financial support, and I'm not necessarily advocating that product. I'm just trying to give you a couple of things I know of. And the key is you want the calcium already dissociated so that you don't need any stomach acid to dissociate it. Taking the calcium and adding some vinegar or some hydrochloric acid might work, but the trouble is I'm a little worried that you'll irritate your esophagus, well, your stomach, basically, which is now your functional esophagus.
My new esophagus.
Your new esophagus. But mostly the place where you're at risk is where they joined it up there in your throat, where they attached the stomach.
Right.
And that area, the skin of that area has absolutely no defense against acid. It's not evolved to be defended against acid. And over time, and we'll come back to that, but over time, you're at risk for getting a secondary cancer or at least dysplastic changes there if you don't take the proton pump inhibitor. So that's the rationale for using it, but it has its downstream bad side effects. B12, right. You can take by shots or you can take under the tongue. You want to monitor methylmalonic acid levels, not B12 levels in your bloodstream. A lot of doctors don't know that.
Okay.
And you are at risk for Alzheimer's and neuropathy if you don't keep the B12 levels up.
Right. So,
and you're at risk for osteoporosis if you don't keep the calcium levels up.
Right.
So you should be monitoring bone markers in your urine. There's something called there are a bunch of them, but the one that's available through our local lab, which, you know, it's infinite wisdom, as far as I'm concerned, shows the wrong test, but is an N-telopeptide, and mm-hmm. that's a urine test. And if that goes up, then that means you're losing bone. So you want to be sure that level, check the level now, and then, you know, maybe every 6 months. And if it's going up, then you've got to do something to increase your calcium and vitamin D because you're losing bone.
So convince my oncologist to
no, do you don't even try to convince your oncologist. Yeah. You're a patient. Go to a primary care doctor.
Oh, okay.
But primary care doctor will probably be convincible. And maybe your oncologist will be and you can try. But if he blows you off, go to a primary care doctor and explain your reasoning.
Yeah, he will.
Yeah.
Yeah, he will. Yeah, that's not a problem.
We will. We want to be in the loop. We want to help you stay alive. We really do. And we know at least something about nutrition. Well, it's true. The education isn't as good as it should be.
True.
Nutrition, actually, it's like politics and religion. It's one of those emotional hot button things that just, I don't discuss nutrition unless people ask me. And of course, on the air here, because I figure this is my time to do that. Anyway, so back to this esophagus issue. Do I need to take long-term proton pump inhibitors? You might be able to get by with nighttime H2 blockers, which only reduce your acid by 60%, and a lot of demulcents, things like aloe vera and marshmallow and deglycerized licorice, which coat the lining of the stomach. And you might be able to get enough protective coating there that you wouldn't have to cut your acid off completely.
Yeah, I figured I was thinking, a short-term acid blocker just for at night, and then during the day, as long as I'm upright, I'm okay.
You know, they're going to be scoping you probably every 6 months or something and looking for trouble. So if you wanted to do that initially, like get it all healed, and then you wanted to talk with your gastroenterologist and say, look, I want to try an experiment. I want to see if I can stop the proton pump inhibitors, use Tagamet or Zantac, which are cimetidine and ranitidine, respectively, these natural substances, and I want you to monitor me and make sure this is working out okay.
Right.
One thing you will get with prolonged use of proton pump inhibitors is you will get overgrowth of the gastrin-producing cells, the parietal cells in your stomach. They will upregulate and multiply. And and that's not necessarily good because then you've got more stomach acid being produced. So I would try to get it healed quickly and back over to this if you're serious about doing this.
Well, sure I am, yeah.
Because if you did the PPIs for a couple of years, get all that hypertrophy of your parietal cells, I don't know that you can back out from there.
Right, okay. Yeah, and incidentally, I am going through chemo and radiation. And the chemo hasn't been too bad. I haven't got to the radiation part yet. But I'm in the midst of all of this right now, but I'm being an ex-ICU nurse. I'm kind of have traditional medical, look on things. But
where do you live?
I live in Aptos.
In Aptos. Look, why don't you give me a call at my Optimage office? You can just go to the Ask Dr. Don website. Give me a call. I'll talk to you some more, okay?
Okay, that'd be great. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Let's go to Sarah in Live Oak. Hello, Sarah, and welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
This is about arthritis.
Okay.
I've had problems in my shoulder for a couple of years, and I've gone to physical therapy, and I've done all that. And, yeah, I have a little more range of motion, but it still always hurts. And so the doctor did an x-ray and said, you have arthritis, and you have bone spurs.
I'm sorry, and which joint is this?
The shoulder joint.
Shoulder joint, okay.
On the right side, and I'm right-handed.
All right, so a bone spur there means that you have calcium in the supraspinatus ligament, most likely.
Yes.
And that ligament has to slide under the acromion, and if you've got calcium deposits in it, it's like rubbing two bones together.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So the doctor said the most likely thing is the specialist is going to want to do a cortisone shot, and, the other possibility is surgery, and, I hear the word surgery, and I go, ah! And I remember when I was in my 20s, I'm 63 now, in my 20s I hurt my knee and somebody said, whatever you do, don't get a cortisone shot. And so I've remembered that. So what would be the pros and cons of getting a cortisone shot? And are there diets where I can reduce the arthritic condition? Because, I mean, arthritis is chronic. That means it's just going to get worse.
Well, let me start with that last statement of yours. Arthritis is chronic. That means it's just going to get worse. I have to tell you that arthritis is a degenerative condition where the type of arthritis we're talking about, which is osteoarthritis, is a degenerative condition where you gradually lose cartilage. And over time, this can create inflammation. And it's the inflammation that creates the pain.
Mm-hmm.
I have people who come in and they've got knee pain, and let's say, for example, knee pain. And I look at their x-ray and it's like, my goodness, this person has years worth of arthritis. And so I say to them, have you had knee pain in the past? Has this ever happened before? And they're, I have been fine, doctor. And this is the first time my knee has hurt me. And I'm looking at, 4 or 5 years minimum of buildup of this level of arthritis. And I'm thinking, So they just now got the inflammation. They've had the arthritis all along.
Mm-hmm.
But the itis part means inflammation. So they've had loss of cartilage. It hasn't been inflamed. Now it's inflamed. Is there anything we can do to reduce the inflammation? Which brings us to the cortisone. I use a lot of cortisone in shoulders and knees, and I find it very effective for reducing inflammation. I use it in people who've torn a meniscus acutely and they're having pain that lasts after more than a couple of weeks. I'll generally try to get them to do acupuncture, but if they can't afford it or I need to be within my health plan doctor, it's like, okay, we'll try a steroid injection. And often that is very helpful for them. So I'm nothing against using steroids in joints. I think it is a legitimate medical practice. Downside risks that I always make a point of telling my patients, it can weaken the tendons and ligaments locally. So we don't inject the Achilles tendon, for example, because that can snap.
You fall over.
And then you're lamed, basically, for many, many months. So we don't go there. The knee, it's rare that you weaken the ligaments significantly, but if someone was, say, engaged in some sort of active sport, I'd be sure to warn them that that could happen. Skiers, I would probably have them ski with a brace, for example, because of the forces involved when they fall. With respect to the shoulder, if you were to fall on the outstretched shoulder a week after your steroid injection, you might conceivably be at higher risk for snapping the tendon. Mm. So don't fall on the outstretched arm. Tuck and roll, I guess, is what I'm saying there. Not that you'll have the ability to override your reflexes in the milliseconds of time before you hit the ground, but...
No, I did. I had a hip replacement, and I started to fall recently. And while I was falling, I arched my body so that I wouldn't fall on the hip.
Well, good for you. Okay, well, in that case, there's your tip on the shoulder. A lot of times, just the act of sticking the needle in there, I think, can be quite helpful. And, of course, I'm an acupuncturist, so I think that some of the benefit from steroids may very well come from actually needling the acupuncture points that happen to be where we are in the textbooks. We're told to stick the needles if we're doing a steroid injection. They're all in acupuncture points, which I find just amazingly fun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, the overlap of the two sciences often happens in surprising ways. With respect to the diet question that you asked, which is a great question, and thank you for asking it. There are some
basic... It ties on to the cancer thing you were just talking about.
Totally. And so let's talk about what constitutes an anti-inflammatory diet. First of all, anti-inflammatory diet means you don't feed inflammation by giving the prostaglandins a lot of good substrate. Prostaglandins are the pain substances or the chemical signals that create inflammation. They're at the end of a long cascade of genetic signaling. When we take ibuprofen or we take Celebrex, we are taking a drug that blocks the final enzymatic step in the pathway of producing prostaglandins. But there are really two flavors of prostaglandins. There are prostaglandins that are made from the omega-6 fatty acids and the ones that are made from the omega-3s. And I'm a big omega-3 advocate. That's what the fish oil thing is all about, or the flaxseed oil. And when you make the prostaglandins out of omega-3s, they are less aggressive and less powerful in terms of inflammatory signals. When you make them out of omega-6, they're bigger, stronger, harder, better, flashier, and they create more inflammation, which you don't necessarily want.
Right.
In the course of our modern lifestyle, we've started eating a lot of animals that are fed grain, because grain is cheap and subsidized by the government, and we like meat. So grain-fed animals have more omega-6 than buffalo or something that's out there living off grass. Of course, you can make a buffalo meat bad by giving them corn, and you can make cow meat healthy by giving them grass or healthier. And you can even buy eggs now where they've added seaweed to make more omega-3 in the egg.
Oh, is that how they do it?
Okay. Yeah, and so you can do these things and manipulate what's going into your mouth. You can reduce the amount of vegetable oil. Now, vegetable oil is better than saturated fat, with the exception maybe of coconut oil. But vegetable oil is high in omega-6, and so it's pro-inflammatory.
So I do stir-fry with olive oil, and I should be using coconut?
I would not do stir-fry with olive oil, because when you heat that olive oil to the temperature you're supposed to for a stir-fry, you actually are oxidizing the olive oil. So I would use something like coconut oil in small amounts for stir-fry. And or you could use canola oil, which is also a monounsaturated. And I don't think there's any studies that really are head-to-head superiority studies there. But the point is, don't use olive oil and heat it up hot.
Okay,
so that's one. Number two, a lot of the prepared foods, the bakery goods, cereal, salad dressing, just about all of the manufactured foods have omega-6 in them. So you want to make your own salad dressing. You want to maybe bake your own biscuits. And as far as that goes, the more starch you eat, the more insulin you make. Insulin is pro-inflammatory. It upregulates the whole cascade. So you don't want a lot of insulin, which means you don't want a lot of baked goods, sugar, starch, pasta, breakfast cereal, bread. You know, those are things that you want to reduce in your diet if you have arthritis, if you're trying to do an anti-inflammatory diet. And then to the end of the anti-inflammatory diet, we come to, guess what? Can you guess?
Fish oil?
Fruits and vegetables.
Fruits and vegetables.
Fruits and vegetables. We already covered fish oil with the omega-3s. So yes, take some fish oil supplements. Take a lot of fruits and vegetables. Throw a lot of curcumin, which is turmeric and black pepper, on there, because curcumin, which is in turmeric, is a compound that has strong anti-inflammatory properties. It blocks the enzyme upregulation pathway that I mentioned, but it blocks it upstream, very far upstream from where ibuprofen and Celebrex block it. So you get
cumin,
more benefit.
Cumin and
curcumin.
Curcumin.
Which is found in turmeric, and it's not the same thing as cumin.
Oh, okay.
Okay. But curcumin, turmeric, you can actually get it in pills as a supplement. There's a commercial product called Zyflamind. There's a product that I just started stocking in my office by Thorne called Mariva that has a liposomal curcumin in it, so it's supposed to absorb really well. Because getting the curcumin in across the human digestive tract takes a little finesse. It doesn't automatically absorb. Now, in India, where they eat tons of the stuff, they eat it every day, they get enough in that they absorb a fair amount. But where we're trying to just add little bits to our, you know, dainty little wimpy Western palates that don't like that much curry, we have to be a little strategic in how we do that.
Okay.
Let me see if I left anything out. There are a number of other compounds that are anti-inflammatory. I won't cover them today. I think we've given you a good solid anti-inflammatory dietary thing, and this will be up on the web by the end of the week, so you can go back and listen to the podcast or just download it, this segment, to review everything we've covered.
So after the shot, where I have less pain, exercise will become easier,
right?
But the calcification won't go away. Is there any way to make that happen?
Well, I don't know. Maybe if you are doing all of these anti-inflammatory things and moving the arm and doing that freely, you will get some loss of the calcium, but it's kind of like a callus on the bottom of your foot. It's hard to get rid of without going in there and surgically trimming it. But as my beloved Rosemary, who is one of my great role models in life, said to me the other day when I was complaining about something, a callus on my foot, she said, "Is it hurting you?" And I said, "No." She said, "Why don't you just make your peace with the callus as long as it's not hurting you?" And I thought, that's wise. That's just plain old wise. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And we're going to go to our next caller, and that is Joe in Aptos. Hello, Joe, and welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. Well, I'm calling this morning because I really haven't been diagnosed with Crohn's or IBS, and I've had some tests done, and nobody seems to give me a definitive answer. So I don't have any pain associated with it, but I have blood, you know, in my stools and mucus. And right now I'm just on a brown rice diet, and that's, you know, seems to be helping. But I was just wondering if you could, you know, shed some light on that.
All right. Well, first of all, Joe, how old are you?
49.
And have you ever had any other autoimmune disease like hypothyroidism or psoriasis or anything like that?
No.
Okay. And looking back on your symptoms, did they start in your teens and young adult years, or is it something that started more recently than that?
Yeah, it started about 3.5 years ago.
Okay. So let's go back to the last 5 years. Major travel with a bad case of turista or diarrhea, traveler's diarrhea, I mean, major infection with a lot of antibiotics or major life stressors, anything like that in the last 5 years?
No, but what did happen was I quit smoking. And then I read some information on that smoking has something to do with bringing on Crohn's possibly, or have you ever heard of that?
I have to take the Fifth Amendment on the smoking and Crohn's connection, because there may be one, but I'm not sure about its directionality. Smoking does worsen cervical cancer because it impairs the immune system. So my logic there, and it's just an extrapolation, would be, well, if smoking impairs an aspect of cell-mediated immunity that prevents cervical cancer, which we know Crohn's disease is a cellular-mediated immunity disease, so maybe the smoking was suppressing this autoimmune thing, and when you stopped smoking, you weren't suppressing it anymore, so it popped up. Probably you should be checked for the antibodies against wheat gluten, and these are tissue transglutaminase, the IgA and the IgG. And you should also get the DNA for gluten, which is DQ2 and DQ8. And these are commercially available tests. And the point here is that gluten sensitivity or molecular mimicry around gluten is a common trigger for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And we think that molecular mimicry, which is something I talked a little bit about in a previous program this month, and also there's a blog posting right now on my Facebook page about molecular mimicry that explains the mechanism and how this happens. But essentially, to be brief, a bacteria or a substance like gluten activates the immune system and sends a danger signal. And the immune system then starts making activated T cells against that molecule that it associates with the danger signal, which might be your own bowel wall. And then you're attacking your own bowel wall because of a case of mistaken identity.
Right. I mean, I'm sure it's different with everybody, but, you know, how long, if you get off wheat 100%, how long does it take? I mean, could it take weeks, months?
You're kind of presupposing that you're going to get cured. And
right.
Once you're immunized against wheat, it's like being immunized against polio. Over time, we know that the immune reaction fades, which is why we give polio boosters to adults who are going to go off to the parts of Southeast Asia where there's still polio. And the same thing with your tetanus vaccine boosters, right? So we know the immunity wanes, and it then is sluggish to it react. So after 6 months or 12 months, most people who have a gluten or any other food sensitivity for that matter will be able to tolerate short-term small exposures. But if they go back to eating it every day, they're probably going to re-immunize themselves. And that's a probably, because maybe they've changed their lifestyle, and maybe they've improved their barrier function in their intestines, and maybe they're no longer stressed out. And so the things that were setting up that reaction in the first place have been eliminated, and those people can sustain a prolonged remission.
Right.
So that's why I asked those questions about what was going on in that 5 years, because I'm wondering, well, was it a one-time stressor, or is there something more constitutional in this individual that's not going to shift? So I really like it when I can identify a trigger, because then I feel more confident that we can get the person back to just a low level of sensitivity and sustain their remission. There are also certain bacterial infections of the intestine which are associated with ulcerative colitis. There's bacterial infections that are associated with arthritis, for goodness sakes. And it's, I've got Pseudomonas in my colon, and I'm getting multiple sclerosis because the Pseudomonas in my colon has a protein on it that looks like myelin basic protein. So your immune system gets trained to attack myelin basic protein and then goes after your brain. Mm-hmm. So there are all of these distant effects as well as local effects going on. And harking back to the mathematician who was on NPR this morning, complex systems are complicated and hard to predict.
Right.
So essentially what I think you need is you need a good functional medicine physician to be working with you on diet and on doing these ascertainments. This is not, unfortunately, this is not your father's medicine anymore, and it's not your health plan's medicine either. But it's important that you try to work with someone. There are books that you can read. I know that Charlie gave you an interview that you could access, which is the Gerard Mullen interview from June 13th, 2009. That's in the archives at Ask Dr. Don. These are all things that you should be looking at.
Mm-hmm. Have you had pretty good success with patients?
Yes, well? I have had astonishing success. And I've also had astonishing failures. I have to tell you about one failure because it's instructive. I had a patient with very bad ulcerative colitis who had done extremely well on a gluten-free diet with some acupuncture and some herbs. His symptoms were controlled, and he was a person who had emotional issues and was in a somewhat challenging marriage. He went to a family reunion, and he was embarrassed not to eat. It was in the Midwest, so need I say more about what was on the table? There wasn't anything that he could eat, basically, that was on the diet I had given him, and he was too embarrassed not to eat what was put before him, and he ended up with such a bad flare of his ulcerative colitis that they had to remove his colon while he was there in the Midwest. And I am convinced to this day that I actually, by helping him in a way, I made it worse, because if he had not been doing well, he wouldn't have been able to have such a massive reaction. If he'd been in pain and suffering all the time rather than having 6 good months, then when he re-exposed himself, I think when he re-exposed himself, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
And so once you go on this kind of pattern, you have to stick with it. You can't just say, oh, well, off I go. I'm going to just go have pizza and cheesecake. You might really mess yourself up if you did.
Yeah, understandable.
So it's it's a lifestyle. That's my point.
Yeah, well, I'll check the website out and possibly give you a call at some point.
Okay. So
all right.
Thank you very much, and have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
Bye. And for those of you who are looking for those Facebook posts I mentioned earlier in the program, go to Ask Dr. Don and hit the Facebook button. Apparently, there's a problem with searching. If you search while logged onto Facebook, you get our website and not the Ask Dr. Don Facebook page. So use the Facebook button. You can also do a Google search. If you put Facebook Ask Dr. Don, that will get you the right Facebook page. Oh, my God, complex systems. Here we go. More of the same. We have time for one caller, and we're going to take Paul in Felton. Hello, Paul, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Don.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I almost a year and a half ago, I had a biopsy that showed low-grade, early-stage prostate cancer. And at that time, the options given to me were surgery or radiation. And I did a little research and came back to my urologist and asked about the kind of monitoring, and you mentioned the Dean Ornish stuff. And he said, yes, normally it hasn't in the past been for younger men, and I think he said that generally meant under 70, but that increasingly it's being considered that way. So that's what I've been doing for the last year and a half, and I wanted to put in a plug for that, because even if it's just delaying one of those two treatments, which sometimes is the case, for me, it's every year delay is great because of the side effects that often come with those two. And I wanted to mention that for me, it's been invaluable to work with another doctor, a naturopathic doctor, who has worked with me on all my health issues as they might create conditions for the prostate cancer to develop. And it's been an incredible journey, and I would encourage anyone who's younger who gets this diagnosis to consider it, even if active surveillance isn't put forth as, you know, one of the preferred treatments.
I'm so glad you called. Thank you very much for seconding this. And I think that when we really look at the data, we are unable to show that we extend people's lives by these treatments. And we certainly increase their suffering. by these treatments. So it's like, wait a minute. Why are we doing it? Well, we're doing it because we feel so uncomfortable about just standing there. I have a great expression, which is don't just do something, stand there. Because if you don't know that what you're going to do is going to make an improvement and there is going to be a cost, then doing it just for the sake of doing something is irrational. And we do a lot of irrational things in contemporary medicine. So I want to praise you for having the courage to stand there and do other things which make your system a less permissive environment. If I take a bunch of weed seeds and I throw them out in the Sahara Desert, they aren't going to grow. And what we want to do is we want to make our body physiology and immune system the equivalent of a Sahara Desert for cancer cells so that they just can't thrive. We can do that. Even though we can't necessarily kill the cancer cells, we can definitely make them very, very, very unhappy with things that don't necessarily hurt or make us sick.
Yes. And I know we only have a minute left, but I'll just say it's wonderful in this county anyway to have an MD and a holistic doctor who, in a way, are working together through me in the sense that they want to know everything about each other's suggestions and comment on them. And so I feel like I'm getting really the best possible approach.
Well, I want it to be even better, but thank you very, very much for your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we've got just like 1 minute, so I wanted to send out a reply to an email I got from Anonymous in Princeton, who's breastfeeding her 16-month-old daughter and is having a lot of thirst, lots and lots of thirst. Anonymous, I think you need to get a urine glucose checked and a specific gravity and a chemistry panel. And I also would say that Sjogren's disease, which is a dry mouth, could manifest as thirst. So if all of those tests that I've mentioned are normal and you continue to feel very thirsty, ask yourself, is it thirst or is it my mouth just dry? After birth, autoimmune disease is common. And so I'm a little bit worried that you might actually be developing an autoimmune disease that is attacking your saliva glands. So get thee to a doctor and discuss these issues, please. Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I hope that you have enjoyed it as much as I. I'm going to, as I said, be actively blogging on my Facebook page about these cancer issues and also about the immune system. It's all interconnected. When I try to break it out to topics, I found I really can't. It's all connected. In that spirit, this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.